From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Third Nation by Lee Hoffman. If she were the two-legged kind, he'd catch her quick enough. Grinning, Hull poked Dayton with an elbow. If she were that kind, I'd be there first, Dayton said. Hull had a wad of tobacco in one cheek. He spat and called, "Go get her, Lacey. Grab her by the trotter." Lacey was a big man and muscled like a prime bull. Despite the chill, there was sweat beating on his forehead. He pushed back his kepi and wiped at it. Like the other bummers, his face was stained from the smoke of pine knot fires. In the long morning light, his breath was faintly visible. He'd already lunged for the pig 4 or 5 times, and it had scooted away every time. Now, backed up into the angle between an old outbuilding and a piece of rail fence, it eyed him warily. The rest of the foragers had spread out behind Lacey to urge him on and watch the fun. If it had been a full-grown hog, the lieutenant would probably have given orders to shoot it rather than waste time running the lard off it. But it was a young one. From the look of it, it had been rooting wild instead of penned to fatten. So the lieutenant stood back and let the men enjoy a little sport. "I'll get her this time, Lace," he said. Again he lunged. Again the pig scooted away. Frantic, it charged toward the wall of men. Shouting and laughing, the men converged to head it off. The pig wheeled and darted toward the end of the fence. "Flank it, boys, flank it," the lieutenant called. The pig turned again, this time heading straight at Cahill. Cahill was the youngest one in the company. He looked more like a drummer boy than a fighting man, but he'd been blooded at Resaca. Now he took pride in being one of Sherman's bummers. As it charged past him, he grabbed for the pig. His hands connected, but the pig squirmed out of his grip. Tail up, it headed across the overgrown pasture toward the woods. "I'll get her," Cahill lit out after the high-tailing pig. Fun was fun, but pigs were food. The lieutenant shouted, "Shoot the damn thing before it gets away." Nash was the sharpshooter of the company. He'd got himself a breech-loading Spencer and claimed he could cut the middle star out of a rebel battle flag at 1,000 yards. Slinging the rifle to his shoulder, he set his sights and called, "Leave her be, boy. I'll get her." Maybe Cahill didn't hear him. Or maybe he was just too excited and set on making the capture. He kept going, but the pig was gaining ground fast. Nash had a clean line of sight. Leading the target, he closed his finger on the trigger. As the hammer fell, the pig swerved. Dirt and grass spattered where the pig had been, but the pig was already racing into the woods. For all it was gaining on him, Cahill was still hard after it. "Oh, hell," the lieutenant said. Whooping as if it were a band of rebs they were chasing, the rest of the company lit out after Cahill. It would have been a poor place to chase a reb who might shoot back, but as woods went, it was a pretty good one for hunting a pig. All of the pine and live oaks held their leaves all winter. In December, much of the other foliage had browned and fallen, making a crisp mat on the ground. The undergrowth was mostly a tangle of bare branches. A man could see a good ways into the woods, and could hear brogans crunching the fallen leaves. The pig flashed in and out of sight among the tree trunks. Cahill in his dark blue field jacket and light blue trousers stayed easily visible. Hull saw the pig scramble over a wind-fallen tree, and Cahill spring up with a foot on the tree trunk. Suddenly Cahill disappeared behind the tree, and Hull heard a high, sharp scream. He thought it was the pig squealing, that Cahill jumped it and caught it, but the scream stopped, and a caught pig usually kept squealing. as he reached the windfall, he saw Cahill sitting on the ground, one leg stretched out in front of him. The other was drawn up, and Cahill was hugging it tight, rocking a bit. Hull had seen men hug themselves and rock that way before, on the battlefield. Wounded men. Dayton reached Cahill first and knelt beside him. The others came up, circling around him. Hull heard Cahill say, "I think my leg's broke." His voice was hoarse with pain. The lieutenant was last to arrive. As he loped up, Dayton told him, "Sir, Cahill's broke his leg." Hull could see what had happened. The log was half rotten. There was a hole in the top where Cahill's foot had gone in and caught. Off balance, he'd fallen, wrenching his ankle. "Let's see," the lieutenant said, gesturing for Dayton to reveal the wound. Dayton dropped to one knee. With his penknife, he slit the trouser on Cahill's outstretched leg. When he peeled back the cloth, there was no sign of blood and the leg looked straight. It wasn't until he took hold of Cahill's brogan that Cahill grunted with pain. Gently he removed the brogan. Wrinkling his nose, he said to Cahill, "Don't you ever wash your feet?" Cahill managed with a weak grin. "I didn't know you were going to be sniffing around them." When Dayton had bared Cahill's leg and foot, the lieutenant moved him aside and knelt for a look. He ran a hand down Cahill's shin, then touched his ankle. Cahill fought against showing pain, but he couldn't hold back a couple of whimpers. Finally, the lieutenant stood up again and wiped his hands. "I don't think there are any bones broken," he said. Cahill looked disappointed. "I can't stand up." "Oh, you're hurt all right," the lieutenant agreed. "I think your ankle's dislocated. We'll have to get you back to the surgeon." "If that's all it is, I can fix it," Heinicke said. The lieutenant gave him a questioning frown. Heinicke explained, "My pop's a horse doctor, sir." "It works for a surgeon," the lieutenant said. "Sooner it's done, the better," Heinicke told him. He hesitated. "If you're sure you can do it." "Yes, sir," Heinicke said proudly. He looked at the men gathered round him. "A couple of you fellers take hold of him. Hold him tight." "I'll do it." Setting down his musket, Lacey stepped behind Cahill and wrapped his arms around the boy's chest. "What you gonna do?" Cahill asked. Unspeaking, Heinicke grabbed the boy's foot and tugged. Cahill screamed and then went limp. "Oh, Lord," Lacey whispered, bracing the boy in his arms. "He's died." "Passed out," Heinicke said. "Best thing for him." He worked at the ankle a few moments longer, then sat back on his haunches and wiped his forehead. "I expect that'll fix it, but he ain't gonna be able to walk on it for a while." There was sweat on the lieutenant's face, too. He drew a kerchief from a pocket and wiped at it. "Lacey, can you carry him?" "Yes, sir." "All right, you take him back to that farmhouse." "What about the pig, sir?" Dayton asked. The lieutenant gave a little laugh. "That old pig will be halfway to Savannah by now." Dayton muttered, "I had my mouth all set for fresh pork." "Don't worry, we'll find another one." The lieutenant turned back to Lacey. "Stay with him. Soon as we forage up a horse or mule, I'll send it back for you to carry him on to camp." "Shouldn't somebody else go along with him, sir? In case those Reb deserters are around here somewhere," Hull suggested. It had been several days since the planter told them about being robbed by Rebs running ahead of Sherman's march. And several days before that one had happened. The odds were against them still being in the area, but Hull had a notion to go back and explore the empty farmhouse. When the Sakesh ran off in a hurry, sometimes they left valuables behind. The lieutenant nodded. "Go ahead. Keep a sharp eye out. I'll get somebody back to you as soon as I can." Cahill was coming out of his faint. He choked back the groan as Lacey got him up over his shoulder like a blanket roll. Hull picked up Lacey's musket, and they headed for the farmhouse. The farm was an old one. When he got a good look at it, Hull's hopes of loot sank. This place looked like it had been abandoned long before Sherman's army left Atlanta in flames. The house was built of rough-hewn planks that had weathered to a dreary gray. Rotting planks dangled from the walls, patches of shakes and had scabbed off from the roof as if it had an ugly disease. Both of the big brick chimneys flanking the house had lost their capping. Just a few sections of the rail fence still stood, and the smokehouse door gaped askew. The only signs of life the foragers had seen when they first arrived were Blue Jay perched on the porch roof and the pig that had been rooting around the empty corn crib. The Blue Jay had left when Lacey made his first lunge at the pig. The jay was back when the returning men reached the house. It flew off again as Lacey set Cahill down on the edge of the porch. Cahill was keeping a diary. Once he was settled comfortably, he pulled it out and began scribbling. Lacey stretched out on his back with his hands under his head. Hull stood a while, wondering whether he should suggest Lacey come with him. Together they could look out for each other, but if he did find anything small enough to pocket, he didn't fancy sharing it. Finally, he gave the door a shove. It swung open. "Uncle Billy's orders are to stay out of dwellings," Lacey called to him. He looked back, cocking a brow at Lacey. Despite the orders, they'd gone foraging inside more than one Sekish house on this march. "It ain't hardly a dwelling if there's nobody dwelling in it, is it?" Lacey's grin said he'd been joking. He added, "Remember, it's fair shares all around." "I doubt there's anything in here but rat nests," Hull answered, hoping he was wrong. If it turned out he was, he had no intention of telling Lacey. Musket in hand, he stepped cautiously inside. The room he entered was as damply chill as a spring house. It was an odd kind of cold that smelled of musty decay. A graveyard cold. He tensed at a sound, a faint rustling, like the dry leaves in the woods. Rats in the walls, he told himself, that was all. Ghosts of the dead that lurked in old houses were just tales for scaring children. If he'd ever believed in such thing, he'd lost his faith on the battlefield. When a man died, what was left was cold meat, nothing more. He'd seen that for himself. If there was a spirit in a man, like the preachers claimed, it didn't linger once the body was dead. Of that he was certain. Even so, he shivered at the feel of the place more than the chill. The house looked deserted, but somehow it just didn't feel empty. The corners of the room were filled with shadows and cobwebs. There were old ashes in the earth, and some shrouded bits of snakeskin rubbed off against the rough bricks. A few pieces of furniture not worth hauling off huddled in the shadows. To his right was a half-open door. He peeked in, a battered old table and a couple of chairs, both missing splats. On the table were a stone jug, a chipped plate, and a dented tin ladle. But no cobwebs. He frowned at that. Rats didn't set out dishes. Did spooks? But there wasn't any such thing. Warily, he peered around the room. There were plenty of cobwebs in the corners, and a pine cupboard hulked against one wall. Nothing else. He looked under the table. Nothing there. The cupboard was flush to the floor. No room under it for anything to hide. No rebs in here waiting to jump him. He touched a finger to the tabletop. No dust. No dust on the jug or plate either. How long would it take for a layer of dust to settle on the table? He wasn't sure. Maybe a few days. Whoever'd used the place was probably halfway to Savannah by now, he told himself. Didn't even have to have been a reb. Could have been a runaway slave or a hunter taking shelter. He picked up the jug and sniffed hopefully at its content. Molasses. He set down the jug and went to the cupboard. Inside he found a few pieces of battered crockery, two shriveled sweet potatoes, and several pine cones. The pine cones puzzled him. He thought about it for a moment, then grinned. Didn't need to have been a reb or hunter or slave. Could have been children playing house. That would explain the pine cones. Even so, he edged open the back door slowly and stood back as he thrust out the barrel of his musket. Nobody took a shot at it. He chanced poking his head out. Nobody shot at it either. Relieved, he looked around. There was a small building with a large chimney about 20 feet behind the house. That'd be the kitchen, he supposed. It seemed the Sekesh had a custom of putting their kitchens ways from their houses. Someone had told him it was to keep down the damage when the kitchen caught fire. Holding the musket ready, he crossed the yard. He used the muzzle to push open the kitchen door. A smell of rot hit him in the face. Rat scurried wildly for cover as light spilled through the doorway. Nobody in there, he thought. At least, nobody live. Likely nothing fit to forage either. He pulled the door shut again and returned to the house. Not enough molasses left in that jug to make it worth carrying. Those sweet potatoes were too old and dry. He started back through the parlor. Abruptly he halted. There'd been no sound. Nothing to grab his attention except a feeling, a sudden sense of something wrong. He was at the bottom of the stairs. The staircase pressed tight against one wall as it rose through an opening in the ceiling. He looked up. There was a window at the head of the stairs. Grimy shards of glass hung in the frame. The sun was high enough now to throw jagged streaks of light through the holes. Dust danced in the beams, but no cobwebs ensnared them. Who'd ever been in the house had gone upstairs. Might still be up there, he thought. He scanned the parlor, assuring himself it was still empty, and checked to be sure his musket was still capped. Climbing the stairs, he set each foot carefully as the wall side of the tread to keep it from squeaking. Before his head reached the level of the floor above, he pulled off his kepi and balanced it on the musket barrel, and thrust it up through the passageway. Nothing happened. Cautiously he took another step, looked out onto the second floor landing. No Rebs crouched in the shadows, not even a small spook waving its winding sheet at him. He grinned sourly at himself for even thinking of ghosts. There was a door to either side of the landing. Both were closed, neither was sealed with cobwebs. He climbed onto the landing and decided to try the right-hand door first. He turned the knob slowly, then used the gun muzzle to nudge the door open. As it moved, the room breathed out the odors of decay, and he could hear sounds of scurrying. It had been a bedroom. The bed frame was gone, but an old tick lay crumpled on the floor, leaking mildewed straw through a dozen or more holes. He glimpsed a stringy gray tail disappearing into one. A litter of dropping confirmed that he'd found a rat's nest all right. A massive clothes cupboard stood against the wall, its doors hanging open. The long dry bones of a dead rat nestled in one corner. The skull was facing toward him, its empty socket seeming to stare in surprise at his sudden appearance. He backstepped and closed the door. Behind him, something squeaked. He wheeled. The door he faced was like the one he just turned away from. He stood for a moment, staring at it, listening. He could hear nothing. The noise had been another rat, he told himself. The place was full of rats. He turned the knob, then pushed the door gently with a gun muzzle. Rusty hinges moaned as it swung open. An old clothes cupboard stood against one wall, and a feather bed lay on the floor, but these furnishings did not look abandoned. The cupboard was shut, and the feather bed spread out. A quilt was spread over the feather bed, and someone was under it. The musty stink of the room was tinged with another odor, an ugly, sickly odor he'd smelled often enough before. "You there," he snapped at the quilt-covered figure on the feather bed, but he didn't really expect an answer, not with that smell in the air. He took a step toward the body under the quilt, meaning to prod it with his musket and assure himself it was dead. He stopped short at sight of the face. He'd recognized the outhouse stink of death, death that had been working for days, and he'd been prepared for the sight of it. Since he'd got into this war, he'd seen dead men aplenty. The sight no longer bothered him. Sometimes they died in horrible ways, sometimes with faces half shot off or rotted off by the time he saw them. But on the field, it was always men. This was a woman, a young woman with sorrel hair, undone and combed into a halo radiating from the splotched pallor of her face. Parchment skin molded into a taut image of the bone beneath, as if the flesh between had melted and flowed away. The mouth was open, lips drawn back, and a silent, mocking leer. She hadn't died there all alone, that was damn sure. Someone had been there to close her eyes. On the lid of each was a $3 federal gold piece. He squatted to take them. As his fingers closed on one, he heard a squeak behind him. A voice struck him like a Manet ball, jerking him to his feet, spinning him around. He saw the cupboard door now open and a face staring at him from inside. "You leave my mama alone," she screeched. He scowled in amazement as a child lunged out of the cupboard. She was a scrawny, dirty-faced towelhead. Her filthy, rumpled dress was flounced with tattered lace, and there were holes in stockings that looked like silk. "You put that back," she indicated the coin between his fingers. Shaken, he said, "She's your ma?" The girl nodded and repeated, "Put that back." He looked at the coin, then at the corpse. "Your ma's dead." "I know that. She's gone to heaven to be with Papa, same as Grandma went to be with Grandpa," the girl said. "You give her back that there penny."
"She don't need it now."
"Does too."
"What for?" "You said she's gone to heaven."
She nodded.
"Well, the streets are paved with gold up there, ain't they? She won't miss no couple of," he grinned slightly as he used her description, "pennies."
"Dead people gotta have pennies. They always do."
"No, they don't."
He bent to scoop up the other coin and saw the dull gleam of gold at the dead woman's throat. Nudging back the quilt, he found a lavalier of gold set with a stone as big as his thumbnail and as red as flesh blood. His fingers clamped around it, snatching, breaking the fragile chain it hung from.
"That's my mama's do pretty," the girl protested.
He held up the lavalier, letting it dangle from his fingertips. The red jewel was set into gold filigree. There was enough sunlight to set sparks flashing within the jewel. This was something worth foraging for, he thought. Hell, it was likely worth more than a foot soldier's pay for the whole war. Maybe enough to buy a partnership in a nice little saloon. "What's the dead need with such things?" he said, as much to himself as to the child.
"I don't know," she admitted. "But Grandma got buried with all hers."
He looked from the jewels to the girl.
"All hers?"
"She had a lot of rubies," she pointed to the stone. "That's what I'm named after, Ruby. Grandma had a whole big string of them. Mama said she wore them when she got buried."
Hall stared at the child. Was she telling the truth?
A whole string of rubies would be worth a fortune. Set a man up for life.
He said, "Ain't so."
"Yes, it is.
Where would your grandma get something like that?"
"Mama said she brought them with her when she came over from France. Mama said Grandma had to run away from the bad men who stole her plantation in France. She brought all her do-pretties here with her so the bad men wouldn't get them, too. Grandma loved her do-pretties so much Papa put them on her when they buried her. That's what Mama said. She said she wished he hadn't done that."
Hull grinned, thinking it was a damn fool thing to do, a waste for such things to lie in a grave when the living could be making good use of them. He said,
"Ruby, do you know where they buried your grandma?"
"You give Mama back her pennies."
Here, he handed her the coins.
"And her do-pretty.
You tell me about your grandma first. Where did they bury her?"
"In the churchyard," she said as she returned the coins to the eyelids of the corpse.
"What churchyard? Where?"
She scowled at him as if there was a foolish question.
"Next to the church."
"Is it close by here? Can you show me?" Her expression told him she thought that was another foolish question.
"It's back home."
"This ain't your home?"
"Course not. We wouldn't live in no place like this. Only the Yankees was coming, and we was going to Savannah, only Mama took sick. And we came here, and the bad men came, and we hid. And they took our horse and cart, and Mama died. And I can't find nothing to eat but molasses and old dried-up sweet taters. And you better give my Mama back her do-pretty." As the words spilled out of her, tears trickled down her cheeks, drawing pale tracks through the dirt. Blinking, she gazed at him with a deep sadness.
"You're a bad man, too, ain't you?"
"No, sugar. I ain't a bad man. I'm just a soldier, trying to get along in the world," he said, feeling sorry for the poor child.
but not sorry enough to give up the lavalier. "I don't mean you any harm, but I got a lot better use for this do-pretty than your mamma."
"Hull!" Lacey hollered from below. "Where are you? You all right?"
"Damn it," he mumbled under his breath. Over his shoulder he shouted,
"I'm all right. I'll be right down." "I'm coming up," Lacey called back. "You found anything?"
"Who's that?" the girl asked.
"My friend,"
he said, but at that moment he didn't feel like Lacey was a friend at all. If Lacey saw that lavalier, he was going to want to share, he thought as he stuffed it into a pocket. If Lacey saw the girl, he'd want to know what she was doing there. She was sure to tell him about the jewel. She was already opening her mouth like she was about to holler. Hull wrenched her around, slamming a hand across her mouth, wildly hunting a way to keep her quiet. He could hear Lacey's brogans on the stairs. He had to keep Lacey from discovering her. He could think of only one way. Knotting a fist, he smashed it into the child's head. The blow knocked her out all right. Hurriedly, he shoved her limp body into the cupboard and pushed the door closed. But as he let go, it started to swing open again. He pushed it back and turned the latch on it. Lacey's steps were close. As Hull snatched up the coin from the dead woman's eyes, he heard a board creak on the landing. Then Lacey was at the doorway. He wrinkled his nose.
"What the hell you found?"
"A dead woman," Hull said tautly, the coins clenched in the fist at his side. He shoved the fist into his pocket. Lacey walked into the room and looked down at the corpse.
"Poor thing. What you suppose happened?"
"She came in here and died."
"But how come?"
"How the hell should I know?" Lacey shrugged. Darting a look at the cupboard, Hull thought he'd better get Lacey away before the little girl woke up and began raising a racket. He said, "Least we could do is bury her decent like proper Christians."
"What about her people?"
"If she had people around here, don't you think they'd have taken care of that? Not left her lie here like this?"
"I guess so. We can roll her up in the feather bed. You take the bottom, I'll get the top."
Hull started folding the side of the bed over the body. A bit hesitantly, Lacey began to help. As he lifted his end, he said, "I don't much like dead people."
"Nobody does," Hull said. "That's why they bury 'em."
"Huh? Come on, it stinks in here." They carried the bundle down the stairs and through the parlor. Cahill was watching the door. As they walked out into the porch, he asked what had happened.
"Found a dead body. Gonna bury it," Hull grunted. If the girl began to holler when she woke up, would her voice carry this far? He asked Cahill,
"Can you walk yet?"
"I can't even wiggle my foot."
"Come on," he said to Lacey, and he headed for the steps.
"Set her down a minute. I got to get another grip."
"It's a woman?" Cahill asked as they put the bundle down.
"It was once," Hull snapped. Impatient to be on away from the house, he turned to Lacey.
"I'll carry her. You bring Cahill."
"What? Why?"
"We want to give her a proper, decent Christian burying, don't we? It wouldn't be respectful if Cahill didn't come, would it?"
"I don't think," Cahill began.
Hull cut him short. "It's the least we can do as good Christians, ain't it?"
"I guess so," Lacey allowed.
Cahill shrugged. Hull started trying to gather the bundle up in his arms. It wasn't heavy, but the feather bed was bulky, awkward. Seeing he was having trouble with it, Lacey suggested, "I'll help you and come back for Cahill."
"No, I'll get her all right," Hull said.
Cahill asked, "Where are you going to put her?"
"Away from the house," Hull replied. "A decent distance, in case anybody wants to move in here again."
"Move into this place?" Lacey said doubtfully. Hull's impatience was turning into anger. He stopped himself from snapping at Lacey. Struggling to keep his voice calm and reasonable, he said,
"Somebody must own it. They might want to fix it up someday."
"I suppose so." Lacey sounded doubtful, but willing to give in rather than argue. He looked at Hull, struggling to pick up the bundle.
"I better help you."
"No!" Cahill frowned with amazement at Hull's insistence. He started to speak, stopped, held up a hand.
"Listen."
Hull heard the sound, the jangle and the rattle of a wagon. Wheeling his side on the track to the house, the team was a pair of mismatched mules. They pulled a farm wagon loaded with sacks and casks. Heinke was driving and Yates was at his side. "There," Lacey said happily, "here come the fellers. They can help us with her." "Yeah," Hull muttered, feeling the way the cornered pig must have felt with its back to the fence and the circle of men closing in around it. As the wagon jounced up, Yates swung himself from the seat and strode toward the porch, toward the bundle lying on it. "What you got there? Something good?"
"A dead woman," Lacey told him.
He stopped short. "You killed a woman?"
"We found her dead. Was gonna take her and bury her proper."
Heinecke halted the mules.
"Load up and let's get going."
"They got a dead woman here," Yates told him before Lacey could. But when he had to leave it to someone else to explain, Lacey was eager to talk. Hull stayed silent, letting Lacey tell all he knew about it. Heinecke and Yates agreed that the woman should be given a Christian burial, but Heinecke thought they ought to take the corpse onto the camp and let an officer make the final decision. Yates wanted to go on the way Hull had proposed and make a grave for her in the woods. Lacey sided with Heinecke. Cahill wasn't so sure, not that he disagreed about the burial, but he didn't like the idea of riding back to camp in the wagon with a corpse. Despite its wrappings, its odor was very evident. "Stinking or not," Heinecke said, "we got to take her with us. Might be there's something on her will tell who she is so somebody can get in touch with her kin. You want to search her here, or let a surgeon do it?" Nobody wanted to examine the corpse. They agreed to take it back and let an officer deal with the problem. Hull didn't care as long as they got away from the house before somebody discovered the child in the cupboard. Really ought to let her out before he left, he thought. At least open the latch so she'd be able to get herself out. Patting a pocket, he started for the door. "You fellers, load her up. I'll be right back. I've left my tobacco in there somewhere." "Wait a minute," Heinecke snapped. "You and Lacey found her. You load her up while me and Yates get Cahill on board." "But my tobacco." "Forget your damn tobacco. I'll give you a child of mine. Let's get the hell going before she gets any riper." Hull started to argue, but if they did, they might begin wondering if there was something more than just a lost plug he wanted from in the house. Sucking breath between his teeth, he glanced up as if he hoped to see through the walls and floors into the bedroom, into the cupboard. There was nothing he could do about it. Not lest he wanted to risk losing the jewel and maybe his hide. Sighing, he turned to help Lacey gather up the bundled corpse and heft it into the wagon bed. Despite the pain in his ankle, Cahill refused to ride in the back, so they manhandled him up into Yates' place on the seat. Heinecke swung up next to him and slapped the mules into motion. The others fell in behind. Hull fought the urge to look back. The skin felt drawn taut around his ears. He could hear Jay squawking somewhere in the trees and something else. A faint pounding as of small hands hammering against the cupboard door? Or was it only the blood beating in his ears? Thrusting a hand into his pocket, he clutched the jewel. What was done, he told himself. Think about what he was going to do when he'd turned that do pretty into cold hard cash. Hell, she was only a damn second-ish whelp anyway. What did it matter what happened to her? For a man with coin to clink, there was always liquor to be had somewhere among the troops. Hull had the coin. He got himself thoroughly drunk that night and again the next. The lieutenant had to know about the liquor, but he was no deacon. As long as his men did their job, he didn't make trouble for him. He didn't make trouble for them. Despite the intensity of his hangovers, Hull managed to do his job. With the aid of the whiskey, he managed to wash the unwanted memories into far dark corners of his mind. From the time they'd taken Atlanta, there'd been very little fighting, mainly brief skirmishes with militia. They found fresh earthworks near Okeechee Church, but the Rebs had abandoned them instead of making a stand. Savannah, though proved fortified and defended. General Sherman himself had ridden out a railroad cut for a look and almost got his head knocked off by a rebel cannonball. So the army encamped, eating rice and tearing up railroad track, while Hazen led the 15th Corps down the Okeechee River and captured Fort McAllister. Union ships began bringing supplies up the river to the army, and the engineers got busy providing roads to haul them on. There was a little skirmishing and some artillery fire on both sides, but nothing serious. It began to look like Sherman was planning to settle in for the winter and starve the Rebs out of Savannah. Then, a few days before Christmas, a buggy full of aldermen came driving out of Savannah to surrender the city. Recognizing that a stand would be futile, the Reb troops had stretched pontoon bridges across the river and evacuated up an old plank road on the South Carolina side. So Sherman's forces marched into Savannah with their muskets over their shoulders. Off duty at last, Hull, Dayton, Lacey, and Thorne drifted together to the waterfront. Savannah sat atop a high bluff, overlooking the river. Wharves and warehouses lined the street at the foot of the bluff. Where there was shipping and much coming and going, there was always places where a man with hard money could get a decent cup of whiskey, a game of chance, and the kind of company a soldier wanted after long months of campaigning. It didn't take long to find one. Chuck-a-luck was Hull's game, and luck was with him. Or maybe the dark-eyed young waiter woman who brought drinks at his beck brought him back luck as well. In no time at all, he had doubled his money. The thrill of the winning and the whiskey burned in his veins. When the dice turned against him, he thought it was only a momentary setback, and he bet with all the more furor. It was like a fever, growing hotter and hotter. The more he lost, the more he bet. He called for the waiter woman to bring the bottle and stay by his side while he rolled the dice. He didn't notice when Thorne disappeared upstairs with one of the female waiters, or when Dayton disappeared with another. When Lacey tried to pull him away from the board, he only cursed, emptied his glass, and went on playing. This time the dice paid him. With a whoop of joy, certain his luck was back, he swept his winnings to his side of the board. The waiter woman refilled his glass and took payment from the coins piled in front of him. He didn't notice how much she took. Lacey watched another throw. Hull won again. Shaking his head sadly, Lacey left. As the night wore on, other players left, until only three soldiers and two civilians remained at the table. Again the dice turned against Hull. The pile of coins before him dwindled. Gold $3 pieces were gone. His coppers followed one after another until every cent he'd had was gone. The hell of it was that he felt certain, absolutely certain, that his luck would come back with the next roll. But without something to bet, there would be no next roll and no trip upstairs with the dark-eyed waiter woman. It wasn't until he had awakened the next day, sad and sober, that Hull remembered the ruby lavalier. It was rolled up in a rag, stitched inside his jacket, waiting for him to return north again to a prosperous place where he could find someone with hard money enough to pay him what it was worth. But he still had the feeling his luck was waiting on just one more roll of the dice. He had to lay hands on some coin somehow. There was a way. He pondered it a while. He didn't know Savannah, and he didn't trust the Sekesh. Slaves, though, were grateful to the army that had freed them. Some of them were so grateful they volunteered for the Pioneer Corps. They seemed the likely place to get the information he wanted. A broad-shouldered buck who had been a stevedore knew where to find the pawnbroker with which his former owner had done business. The place the freedman directed him to was a ramshackle wooden cottage that looked as old as the city. There was a brick warehouse crowding it on one side, without quite touching it. On the other side, weeds were overgrowing the charred timbers of a building long gone. Rats scrabbled in the weeds. The windows of the house were shuttered. The roof sagged over the meager porch, and the single chimney leaned at a precarious angle. In the long winter twilight, the place looked abandoned. Memories Hull had pushed away stirred, like waking snakes in the shadowy corners of his mind. He fought them back, refusing to recognize them, but the feeling of them squirmed coldly down his spine as he approached the house. His steps slowed. The chill within him whispered that this couldn't be the right place. Nobody with hard money would live in such a place, he thought. Nobody with any choice would. Plantation slaves had better cabins than this. As he stood pondering, a twist of smoke rose from the chimney. Somebody was inside. Maybe somebody could tell him where to find the pawnbroker. He stepped up onto the porch, boards groaned under his weight. As he reached out to knock, the door opened. A man, who looked as old as the house, peered out at him. Startled, he backstepped. "Don't worry, Yankee. I don't bite." The old man's words were misshapen, his voice hardly more than a rattling in his throat. He grinned, lips drawn back from brazen gums. "What you want here?" "I'm looking for a Mr. Hornbeck," Hull said. "Can you tell me where to find him?" "What you want with him?"
"Business."
"Who sent you?" He snapped the words out like an officer giving orders. Automatically, Hull answered. "Captain Jarrett's Willie." The old man gazed at him from shadowed hollows like empty eye sockets. "You know Jarrett?"
"I know Willie. He's joined the Pioneers."
"A better man than Jarrett," the old man mumbled. He stepped back, opening the door wider. "Come on inside." Hull looked past him into a room lit only by a small hearth fire. Thoughtfully, he said, "Hornbeck's here?"
"Better man than you, too," the old man added under his breath. Aloud, he said,
"Who the devil do you think you're talking to?"
"You're Hornbeck?"
"I ain't gonna live forever. Come inside and state your business, or go away and leave me have my supper while I'm still spry enough to swallow it."
Hull thrust a hand into his pocket. His fingers located his Barlow knife and closed around it. Wishing he had his musket with him, he stepped inside. Hornbeck lit a lamp and turned the flame high. This was a lot better. Hull glanced around. There seemed to be only the one room and some kind of loft reached by a ladder. He saw a small bed behind the ladder and a comfortable-looking chair drawn up near the fire. Two side chairs faced each other across the table in front of the hearth. The walls were lined with sideboards, cupboards, chests, and cabinets, no two alike. Unless somebody was hiding in one of them, Hornbeck was alone. Hull's grip on the knife eased a bit. Hornbeck had been cooking something over the hearth. He swung the pot hook out to clear the fire, then opened a sideboard and took out a bottle. He set it in a pair of glasses on the table. Hull watched him pour. The golden brown whiskey shimmered invitingly in the lamplight. With a gesture, Hornbeck told him to help himself. He picked up a glass and tasted the whiskey. It was a smooth, rich, sipping kind. But Hull took a long, deep swallow, the heat of it in his throat thawed the chill in his spine. "Sit down," Hornbeck said, seating himself at the table. "Show me what you've got." Hull reached into his pocket and brought out the rag-wrapped bundle. Peeling back the rags, he set the lavalier on the table in front of him. The admiration and pure greed that flashed in Hornbeck's eyes was as bright as reflected lamplight that flashed in the ruby's heart. The old man reached out bony fingers and closed them gently on the lavalier. He held it close to his face, studying it, turning it to catch the light. Softly, he asked, "For sale or pawn?" "Pawn," Hull said. "How much?"
Hornbeck eyed him as intently as he studied the lavalier. Setting it down on the table, he replied,
$10.
Hull snatched it. "You're crazy."
"Gold," Hornbeck added.
"Willie told me you were fair," Hull said as he started up from his seat. His fists clenched. He had a mind to show this old man what he thought of the offer. Hornbeck shook his head.
"I'm not fair.
You take that to some other pawnbroker. Maybe he'll offer you as much as a third of what it's worth. When you go back for it, maybe he and it will be gone. The devil knows where. You want to pawn it? You can be sure I'll keep it as long as we agree on. And I'll give it back to you for the amount we agree on." "The honest? You're planning on coming back for it, ain't you?"
"Damn right I am. I'll be back for it tomorrow."
"Then take what I offer. The less you take, the less it'll cost you to get it back." Hull had never looked at it that way. It made kind of sense, but $10 just didn't seem like enough, even in gold. As he thought about it, he emptied the whiskey glass.
"You know another honest pawnbroker in Savannah?" Hornbeck asked as he refilled it.
Hull had to admit to himself that he didn't.
He thought some more and drank some more. Finally, he said, $50.
I thought you said you'd be coming back for it.
I will.
You go spend $50 now.
That's what? Near 4 months' pay for you?
Where are you going to get the money to pay me back?
How much you going to charge me for the pawn?
Quarter month.
Quarter eagle? Hull said, thinking that wasn't so bad.
Quarter the amount, Hornbeck told him.
If I was to lend you 50, which I ain't gonna do, you'd owe me $62.50 next month.
You sure ain't fair.
If I only lend you 10, all you'll owe me next month is 12.50.
The old man was right.
Still, $10 just didn't seem like enough. Hull said so.
Hornbeck shrugged.
Feeling put upon, Hull said, 40?
Hornbeck filled his glass again and waited until he'd drunk from it before speaking.
You said you'd come back for it tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'll make a deal with you, soldier. I'll lend you 25 in gold, and you come back with it tomorrow. Like you say, I won't charge you nothing for the loan. But if you don't come back for it tomorrow, that pretty red do-pretty is all mine.
That wasn't fair either, Hull thought. But the confidence in him was as strong and warm as the whiskey he'd drunk. He didn't doubt luck would be with him at the dice table, he said.
You'll give me a paper says all that?
I surely will.
They drank to the agreement. Then Hornbeck sent Hull to wait on the porch. Hull took the lavalier with him. After a few minutes, Hornbeck came to the door and put 6 coin into Hull's outstretched hand. 4 quarter eagles and 3 half eagles. He waited patiently while Hull tested each with his teeth. Satisfied the coins really were gold, Hull gave over the lavalier and Hornbeck gave him the receipt. It was full dark, and turning cold by the time Hull reached the gambling house. 6 of his friends were already there, at the board. They looked surprised to see him, even more surprised when he put 1/4 eagle on the table.
"Where you been?" Lacey asked him.
Dayton asked, "Where'd you get that?"
"Foraging," Hull said with a grin.
The others laughed. The civilian who had the dice cup looked down at the coin, up at Hull, then off to one side. In a moment, the dark-eyed waiter woman appeared at Hull's side with a drink. Just as he anticipated, Hull won on the first toss of the dice, and the second, and again, his luck was back, just the way he'd known it would be. He was sure of it. Exuberantly, he downed his drink and called for another. On the 4th roll, he lost, but on the 5th, he won again. Well, a man couldn't expect to win every time, no matter how good his luck was. The luck stayed with him until the pile of coins in front of him was glittering with gold. With such luck, he ought to buy a partnership in a gambling house instead of a saloon, he thought. The way he was raking in the money, he wouldn't have to settle for a partnership. With all this money and the lavalier, he could have a whole business for himself. When the waiter woman brought another drink, he wrapped his arm around her waist and pulled her close, rubbing his cheek against her hip. Warm and soft and so good-smelling, he felt like running her upstairs right this minute, but the clank of money drew his attention back to the chuck-a-luck board. The woman stayed there until he was ready for another drink. When she walked away, it was like she took his luck with her. The dice turned against him. He called her back, but that didn't help. His heap of coins was shrinking fast. The faster it went, the harder he bet. He cursed and pushed the woman away. He wanted no distractions. He had to win back the gold. He had to have $25 when he left the table. It wasn't just the little money riding on the dice. It was a ruby lavalier. It was his saloon, his future. Breathing hard, sweating, his eyes were intent on the board, the coins, the dice. He watched the civilian's long, sharp fingers rake up the coins that should have been his, that had been his moments before, again and again. And then there were no coins left, nothing. But the feeling was there, the certainty that he could win on the next roll, that he would win. His luck had to come back. His mistake had been sending the waiter woman away, he thought. He'd been lucky when she was at his side, hadn't he? Desperately, he looked around for his friends. He might be able to borrow from them. They were gone. His money was gone.
His glass was empty. Even the waiter woman was gone. He turned to the nearest man in Federal blue. They were comrades in arms, weren't they? A long way from home, among strangers, among enemies. They had to stick together, didn't they? Surely the soldier would help out a fellow with a small loan, just a few cents. The soldier only laughed. He asked another and got shoved away, called a stinking drunk. As he started toward a third, a civilian in shirt sleeves laid a hand on his arm. "Friend, I think it's time for you to get back to camp." "I just need a few coppers," Hull whined. "Just lend me enough to get back in the game. I'll win next time. I know I will." "You stop pestering the paying customers. Go get some more money somewhere else if you want to get back in the game," the civilian told him. "But..." "Now, you go on." The man's fingers tightened on his arm, digging in, hurting. Hull realized that that man was as big as Lacey and probably as strong. Likely, he could crush bone with those fingers. Still pleading, he let himself be led to the door. The man gave him a shove and slammed the door behind him. As he started down the steps, his foot slipped and suddenly he was tumbling, slamming face first into the cobbled walk. He lay still, his mouth filling with a salt taste of blood, his face filled with pain. When he finally pulled himself up, he realized he was shivering. Realized it was cold, and very dark. There was a lamp flickering at the corner. He staggered toward it. As he passed the protection of the corner building, a damp, ugly wind hit him, cutting through his field jacket. Felt like the blood that seeped from his nose was freezing in his mustache. Wasn't supposed to get so cold in the south, was it? But there was ice skinned over the puddles in the gutters. Have to watch his step. He pressed a hand against the wall to steady himself. Had to think. Needed money. Had to get that lavalier back. He remembered Hornbeck's shack. The old man had been alone there. Not even a dog. Nothing there but a shriveled up old man and a ruby lavalier. A lot of money hid somewhere. Old bastard had no business asking a quarter a month for a loan. Damn thief. Would serve him right if he got foraged. But where the hell was the shack? Which direction was which? He turned the corner and got turned around somehow. The stars were no help. A black sky was belly down on the treetops, not blinking so much as a single star. Wind be off the river, wouldn't it? Felt like it. The shack had been near the river. He headed into the wind. As he walked, his mind drifted. On a long march, a man could learn to sleep after a fashion while he was walking. Not really sleep, but an unawareness that was close to it. Suddenly he realized he wasn't walking into the wind any longer. There was icy rain in the wind now, and he had his back to it. He had been drifting like an animal, ahead of a blizzard. Where the hell was he? It was too dark to tell. Felt like grass under his feet. That didn't help much. Savannah was full of grassy squares. He hunkered down, shielding it against the wind with his body. He struck a sulfur match. It flared just long enough for him to glance around, then sputtered out. In that quick glance, he'd seen odd shapes, low shapes, upright slabs, low structures. He struck another match. God damn! Tombstones! He was in a graveyard! He felt a sudden shivering down his spine, as if snakes were squirming through it. Snakes of memory refused by the mind. But a graveyard was no different from a field after battle. Except there was dirt and markers over the dead, he told himself. He'd had truck enough with the dead in the past. He didn't fear them now. Fact was, the dead had done well by him. It was a dead woman who'd given him the lavalier. Remembering that, he remembered the little girl telling him his grandma had been buried wearing even finer jewels. He didn't want to remember the child, but the jewels, that was worth thinking about. He'd heard tales of grave robbers finding gold rings on corpses, no telling what the dead of Savannah got buried wearing. He figured this was the same graveyard he'd seen by the daylight a few days before. An old place going back to colonial times. Not everybody in it had been buried under 6 feet of dirt, somewhere in brick vaults. Dead people lived good around here, he thought. The vaults were bigger than a dog tent, and sure to be a lot snugger in foul weather.
If anybody was to get buried wearing fancy jewelry, seemed likely it'd be the people in those vaults. If a man could get into one, no telling what he'd find. He tried lighting another match, but the weather-damp head crumbled when he struck it. Only 2 matches left in the case. Best not waste them. Moving cautiously in the darkness, he groped for stone. His fingers numbed quickly in the icy wind. The rain had soaked his uniform. His whole body was going numb, but the thought of the ruby kept him going. He found a vault by blundering into it, hitting his thigh against the corner so abruptly that it sent him sprawling. Mumbling under his breath, he got himself up and began examining the structure with his hands. It was a low brick enclosure with a slab of marble for a top. From the weathered roughness of the marble, it was old. He gripped the top and pulled. Heavy, he pulled again. It still wouldn't move. He got down on one knee and tried pushing up on it. Too damn heavy. He couldn't budge it at all. Sitting back on his heels, he pondered the situation. Had to be some way to get the damn thing open. If he couldn't get the top off, maybe he could get in from the side. He ran his hands over the bricks. The mortar between them crumbled into sand under his fingers. Hunting the Barlow knife from his pocket, he began to pick at the mortar. It didn't take long. The brick he was working at began to wobble. He slammed it with the heel of his fist. It clattered into the vault, taking others with it. A dank scent of mildew gusted from the hole. Eagerly he clawed at the remaining bricks, pulling loose one then another until the hole felt large enough for a man to squeeze through. Suddenly cautious, he paused. Cold rain trickled down his collar. Shivering, he struck another match. Sheltered in the hole, it kept its flame long enough for him to look in. There was no coffin, just a heap of debris. For a miserable moment, he thought the vault had been empty. Then, even as the match was flickering out, he recognized a scattering of rotting wood and a few pieces of age-grade bones in the debris. The icy feeling of snakes squirmed along his spine again. But the image in his mind was a ruby bright as fire, burning away all thought, all fear. Dropping the matchstick, he wiggled through the opening he'd made. Inside, he tried to sit up. His head hit the marble slab. Well, at least he was out of the rain, out of the wind. Propped on an elbow, he groped for the pieces of wood he'd seen. Identifying them by touch, he made a small pile of them, then struck his final match. The rotten wood was dry. It took flame readily, filling the vault with flickering light. At last, able to see what he was doing, Hull began scratching through the debris. Something round like a coin, but it was only a pewter button. He threw it on the fire. A piece of metal, evidently a coffin plate, was green with corrosion. The name eaten away. Another button, bits of bone, a shred of rotted fabric, broken pieces of brick, more wood. He added the wood to his fire and continued his hunt. Then there was no more wood and the fire was burning low. His fingers ached. He realized they were bleeding. And he'd found nothing. The flame guttered out. The darkness was not total. That puzzled Hull. Twisting, he turned himself within the narrow vault to face the entrance he'd made. Through it, he could see a dim light. The moon had come out, he thought. That'd mean the icy rain was over. Moving closer, he peered through the hole. The light was strange, dim and misty, like a thin fog lying over the graveyard. There was no wind, only a silent stillness as unnatural as the light. Was it the stillness before a storm, he wondered. At least he had shelter inside the vault. Maybe he ought to stay the night there. No. He had to get hold of some money somewhere and get back the ruby. The light was confusing. Nothing looked quite right. He thought he saw movement from the corner of an eye, but when he looked that way, there was only a tombstone. Was it just a trick of the light? He hesitated, gazing out of the vault. Another glimpse motion, another tombstone, then he saw furtive shape that darted from shadow to shadow. He didn't believe in ghosts. Hell no. It had to be something else, a grave robber, he decided. Slowly he grinned. The robber ought to know what grave was worth looking into. Let the robber do the work. Then take his loot from him. That'd be easier than busting open vaults himself until he found the right one. Wait. There was more than one of them. His grin faded. More than one?
more than two. It began to look as if someone was hidden in every shadow, behind every tombstone. A whole damn army of them. Was the one he just glimpsed wearing a kepi? Was that a musket in the hand of the one disappearing behind the tombstone? Oh Lord, he thought. Could it be the Rebs hadn't evacuated the city? Had they just hid out? Were they amassing here now to take Sherman's men by surprise? What if they found him? One lone Yankee, without even his musket? What chance would he have? His eyes seemed to be adjusting to the weird light. He could see a group of them in the shadows of a live oak. Vague shapes. Shadows within a shadow. One leaning on a musket. No, not a musket. It was a crutch. Another with a bandaged head. Another with a crutch. Another in bandages. They were coming out of the shadows. And he could see more bandages, tattered clothes, limping figures supported by their companions. He sighed with relief. Not an attacking army, but walking wounded, lame and halt, moving slowly, coming closer to where he lay hidden. Then he saw the smallness of them. Not a man of them looked full-grown. He frowned in puzzlement. A whole troop of drummer boys wounded in battle? Closer yet, and he saw more were too small even for drummers. And drummer boys didn't wear bonnets. Yes, there were girls among them in ragged skirts, some with bandaged heads or arms or leaning on crutches like the boys, some missing arms or legs or... God help them. Was that one without a head? They came on, and he could see their faces, white faces and black faces and every shade between. Round faces and gaunt faces, hollow cheeks and hollow eyes, eyes that gazed into the darkness, seeing into the darkness, into the vault, staring at him where he lay, staring at the tomb he had desecrated. Suddenly he understood, not from within himself. There was nothing within him capable of such understanding. It was as if they were putting it into his mind silently, wordlessly, giving him comprehension. They were the Third Nation, neither Union nor Confederate, the ones too young to have a say in the choosing of sides and the making of war, the ones brought into life and torn from it by acts not their own, lives unfulfilled, bled away by shot, shell, seared away by untreated fevers, and in burning buildings, shriveled by hunger and disease. The lost children, the murdered children. She stepped forward, a scrawny, dirty-faced towhead. Her filthy, rumpled dress flounced with tattered lace and holes in stockings that looked like silk. He tried to speak, to beg, to tell her he was sorry. He'd really wanted to go back and let her out of the cupboard, but his throat was like ice and his breath a knot in his chest. She took another step toward him. He shrunk back into the vault, on his belly, squirming away from her, until he was against the wall and could go no further. He could no longer see her face or anything else except the entrance hole he'd made into the vault. He could see only the light beyond the hole, the strange thin light like a luminous fog lying against the ragged opening. Suddenly darkness bit a chunk from the rough circle of light. Then another, and another. He realized they were replacing the bricks, sealing the hole. And he knew, without even trying, that this time the mortar would not crumble under his knife.